from the time we should have worked out the system where the AG is able to look at that stuff. But I'm saying right now, the AG says you didn't have the documents. The department, in your management response, says the department provided a response to information which indicated where the documents would be stored. So can we just get a sense before we move on? What is the correct position around support documents? Let's start with the AG's office. Because you continue to raise this as one of your problems, that you don't have the support document. What's your understanding of the support document situation in the department? You could start with the AG and then ask the department what they understand.
Honorable members, through the chair. The issue around the supporting documentation stands. We do not receive adequate supporting documentation that actually addresses the auditor sessions that we are testing. So in the event where we did request documents, they were either not provided or the documents that were provided were inadequate for us to perform the tests that were necessary for the auditor session. Thank you.
Did you kind of get a sense of what the challenges are with support documents?
They are actually, you know,
thank you, DGM members. The issue with supporting documentation, we're talking holistically now, not specifically on any area. It is true that because of the diversified nature of the department, certain sort of supporting documentation sits with the region, specifically for revenue. However, in for expenditure, the documentation sits with head office, because all payments get produced or payments get made at head office. Now, when it comes to the revenue portion of it, the supporting documentation that was not allowed, that was not made available is in terms of application forms that we don't have, because for some of our services that we render, there aren't no application forms. So there is no audit trail as such. There's no supporting documentation from that point of view. In terms of expenditure, by and large, expenditure documents were submitted. However, like the AG said, it wasn't adequate to support the evidence. So in terms of getting that, there are initiatives in terms of getting the admin portion of the work done within the region and within head office. We have recreated supporting documentation in the year under review, but that we have not succeeded to get down every single piece of paper. I can give you examples, but it'll come out a little bit later in the discussion. Thank you.
Just on that matter, you've recreated for the AG for the previous audit. What are we doing to ensure that future audits, there is a system of filing that is acceptable to the AG and the team when it comes to that order? So, is there anything that we're doing around that fashion?
Yes, we are. What we've done, if I can use as an example, Government Garage as an example, because it comes up a little bit later. For Government Garage, we have already appointed 317 officials to actually control the small pieces of paper assigned to Government Garage in terms of fuel slips and the like. The statements we do have, but it's the smaller pieces of paper that either fade or get lost, that where the controls are. So controls have been put into place regarding the supporting documentation. We are engaging with the Auditor General in terms of what equates to sufficient evidence from an audit point of view, because there seems to be misunderstanding there between what our officials keep as documentation versus what supports evidence from an audit point of view. That discussion is ongoing with the AG's office.
And I would imagine, DG, that there is consequence management. In other words, those 300 or 100 odd officials that you've appointed don't perform, that we will then remedy the situation. What I'm saying is, the new parliament comes, sit with you guys next year, the new scope, and deal with matters of this nature, because it will be an indictment on us in terms of our oversight, and it certainly will be a problem for the department. So I'm saying saying that over and above putting those people, I think you need to have consequence management if the task is not performed. I think what we are saying is that at some point we need to blame the fighter. I read to you what you said last year. You said it again this year. We hope it's not going to be said in the new parliament. Similarly, the problems of the AG last year, I know that you cut them down from 26 to 6. The intention now is to make sure that in the next one, there are less than 6, if there's any at all. So there should be consequent management around that. But you spoke about debtors and the fact that debt is not fixed up. Now, for revenue, let's put it that way. For us, that's a major problem. You collect money in the region. The Auditor General doesn't have any way of verifying that money is collected and recorded accurately. He doesn't have that. People are working with cash. It is probably the biggest temptation for corruption, fraud, and that type of thing. What are you doing since the last audit today that can satisfy Parliament that matter is being addressed? Because if anything, that's the one that must be addressed. We can't afford for cash to change hands, and we don't have support documents for that cash.
Thank you. Yes, I agree with the member fully. In terms of addressing that scenario or that problem that we have, the audit covers from April to March, the entire financial year. Thus far, the department is only relying on manual controls, manual registers per office that takes in applications that were done via printouts from the system. Compare that to the cash taking and comparing that to the bank. So all of that is in manual systems. That will still be with us in the future to come. However, not as pervasive as it is now. What we have done already in the month of October is rolled out what we call a receipting solution. In a typical Home Affairs office, we have a cash register, a standalone machine that you find at a corner cafe that is linked neither to the back office system, neither to the accounting system. We have changed that model. We have brought in a point of sale system that links to the production system and to that interfaces into back, the basic accounting system. In that receipting solution that we have, it caters for all 65 transactions that the department engages in, plus services that offices render. As an example, when customers need to send a fax or make photostat copies, that system caters for those types of transactions as well. So we've filtered that down. Now, in terms of doing that, we've rolled out, or in the process of rolling out since October, the pilot, which are 5. They cover, like I said, all 65 transactions, including the immigration type of transactions and the country type of transactions and obviously the civic services type of transactions. Our aim is to have the top 60 sites done by March 2009. That does not take away the revenue problem in holistically. However, the top 60 sites that we're targeting makes up 80% of the revenue generated within the borders of the country. So from that basis, we're going on the 80-20 principle, but there will still be problems as we roll the solution out. So in the current year, like I said, we began in October, and because time has expired, we have to rely on the manual controls since April to September for the majority of the offices. Thank you.
Just an observation. You know, we had this or a similar problem with the Department of Justice. My mother would go to Johannesburg expecting to collect the maintenance because my father delivered the maintenance in Durban or somewhere. And she wasn't able to get it because there was no system like this. Do government departments talk to each other, because they were also seeking a solution to the kind of problem that you're looking at? Or do we have justice doing its own thing, Home Affairs doing its own thing, somebody else doing its own thing? Because if we look at the problem, it's more or less the same. It's about money being delivered somewhere, accounted for somewhere else, manual, there's no system. But we know the Justice Department was investing a lot of money in this thing. Have you guys spoken to the Justice Department, or are you doing something totally different?
We haven't spoken to Justice. I do understand the Justice System. system. They work on the JDAS system. And that was a complete in-house system that was written for them specifically. Our system is based on what is being run at SAR, based on the e-filing. So from a government perspective, it's already within government. Just tailored for Home Affairs. Thank you.
All right, thanks. As long as we're talking to each other around that matter. I think we have and the proof of the pudding is in the tasting in terms of where they work. But a very worrying factor that the ANC picked up is that all these fancy systems that you have, he noted, or the agency noted, that the official or the clerk or the individual at the region has the power to void transactions. Now, you give me 10 rand, I void it, I put the 10 rand in my pocket. You give me 100 rand, I void it, and I show income of 5 rand. So all these systems, without the necessary checks and balances of the warm body, doesn't solve the problem. Our question to you is, are you aware that that's happening, and what have you done to rectify the situation?
Thank you. Yes, we are aware of the situation where that day is just ill discipline. The body of a transaction, in terms of the process, sits at a supervisory level. But given the scenario that we have of a manual cash register, it is possible for a cashier to void that transaction. That is a system that we're doing away with presently. However, the monitoring of those controls from an office management point of view, that we're addressing. We launched what we call the Front Office Initiative. We've given detailed rules around 5 critical areas, finance being one of them, of what an office manager, together with his staff, needs to look at to respect financial discipline within an office. It covers revenue, it covers assets, and various other aspects there. So that is being addressed as well.
Not just the warm body to warm body training. I would imagine, and I would hope, that we're also putting into place system technologically wise, so that it's not possible. Technology could make it that I can't enter into a certain area. So I'm hoping that you're not saying to us that you're just talking to them and giving them a manual of what they must and must not do. You are actually fixing up the system so that they don't allow that access to happen.
Yes, most definitely. In the previous regime, you had to rely on bodies. What we are doing now in the new Home Affairs is putting those fundamental controls within the system. The present system has got a 4-tier responsibility level where individuals are just assigned certain rights and they cannot bypass the system. Behind the scenes, there is a full audit trail of who has done what at what time. So that is in the new system. Thank you.
Right, let's move on. Again, so your branches, because I believe that your biggest focus area, if you want to discuss this department. Again, monies are collected on the last week of March, the last week of the financial year. The Auditor General says to us that those monies must be recorded in the financial year in which they collected. Your response to the Auditor General is that no, the last week will never be recorded in the year in which it was collected, but it will be recorded in the future. Now, the AG says he doesn't accept that. You say you accept that because Treasury has given you permission to do that. I don't see Treasury. But we as Parliament need to understand what is the correct situation around that matter. Money is collected, and we can understand at the last minute of the day. But in that last week, what is the acceptable norm? At what point do we say money collected up to the last day or the second last day or the last hour must be recorded, and what can we give leniency to? Because you see, we don't want this to appear in your audit report in the future. But unless you and the AG and Treasury sort it out, we'll continuously have this problem. So let's ask the Treasury and the AG, what is the accepted norm in terms of money collected on the last day? And then ask you as the department whether you can live with that or do we need to fix it up. Treasury.
No, it doesn't look like we have someone from Treasury yet.
Yeah. Not the AG for their understanding of you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Through the Chair, the Treasury regulations that govern the collection of money refer to the immediate banking of monies collected. And this is obviously a control measure to ensure that all funds collected is banked and that it does not also pose a risk to the staff of that entity by keeping cash on the premises. And also, at year end, you want to ensure all your cash is banked before the year end, so to ensure that your accounting is correct, because you're still counting on the modified cash basis. Then your cash book at the year end should reflect all money that is received at the point of your last financial day. That's in our opinion and per the Treasury regulation. Thank you, Chair.
What does the department say, Mr. Director?
The issue that we're raising here is an issue of cutoff. Now, practically, the department works till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The banks close at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Therefore, all taking in that period, as an example, every day we do banking at 10 o'clock for the previous day's taking. So on the 31st of March, as an example, the first bank will happen on the 10 o'clock, at 10 o'clock on that day. From 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock when we close, that money gets banked the following day. Okay? So there's an issue of cutoff. Now, even if we, the situation is, when we collect the cash, the first issue that needs to happen is receipting of that money in terms of a bank. Then the banking takes place. Okay? The scenario that we have at the end of March 2008, 11 million rand was banked the following day relating to revenue received from customers on the 31st of March. Now that is a situation of sweeping, because when we do bank our money, in terms of the PMG system and the banking configuration within Treasury, the sweeping occurs once a day. That sweeping occurs at a specific period in time. All banking that occurs after that sweeping is recorded in the following day. Now that issue of timing is where we as a department show that banking in the following working day, and we show it as a reconciling item to say we received the money on the 31st, but it's banked on the 1st of April. So we show it as a reconciling item. The Auditor General is suggesting that, and why we do that is because we work on the cash basis of accounting, not on the accrual basis of accounting. Therefore, when the money is banked, that's when the transaction actually is validated. Okay? So from that perspective, we were of the opinion that we were correct. However, I understand the Accountant General's point of view from where they're coming to say, even though the banking occurs in the next day, and it hinges around a technical debate, we would then have to backdate transactions that are posted on the bank statement on the 1st of April. That's basically the cutoff is only in a period of time when we're talking the 31st of March and the 1st of April. So that's the department's position.
So, AG, are you comfortable that money is received before the 31st of March, the 30th bank, let's put it that way, were indeed recorded in the financial year that it should have been recorded? My understanding was the last week. The department seems to be suggesting that it was the last day. What is your opinion on money collected? Let's put the last day aside. But I don't think we can accept that a week's taking would not be recorded. We wouldn't accept that as Parliament. AG, what is your understanding? Was it the last day? Was it the last week? Or are you able to give us a view?
Honourable Member, through the Chair, it was referring to a lengthier period than a day. Okay, that's the first part. The second part is, for recording purposes, the funds will still have to be recorded, although it might not be physically possible to bank it at the end of that day, the day taken on the last day of the financial year. When you are actually doing the accounting for it, because you're on the modified cash basis, and until we go on to the full accrual basis, you'll have to record those transactions for the day in the day that it happens. So although your bank is in equity, you will record on the day and you show it as reconciling items into your bank statement when you do the bank recon, bring back to your cash flow. So that is our opinion, and we have indicated to the department also that they need to consult with Treasury, and then if Treasury has any other view, they need to inform us so we can then consult the Treasury also and then have a uniform approach to it. But in terms of pure accounting, if you are going to be on the modified cash basis, you need to record those transactions in the period that it actually occurred, which might have the effect otherwise of understating your revenue for the financial year report. Thank you.
All right. Let's not get into a dog fight about whether it's the last day or not the last day, but you hear what the AG is saying. And unfortunately, as scope, we have total confidence in the Auditor General and the World Medical Producers, unless somebody comes with something different. But it's an institution that we have total confidence in. And if the AG says that it's not the last day's taking, and in fact it's a longer period, then we have a problem. Because it means that money is sitting in somebody's drawer or somebody's briefcase or in a safe somewhere. And it should be banked ASAP. So we're asking the department to go and fix that up.
Yeah, actually, maybe before you proceed, I think that's a very important point to stress, because your response message seems to suggest that the department in its various regions religiously adhere to the banking by 10 o'clock the following day of transactions that happened the previous day. I think that is the policy position, and that's not what we're discussing. We're discussing implementation of policy procedures. And the Auditor General's report relates to the implementation thereof. So it will not assist you and does not assist us if we don't talk to the challenges that are there in terms of ensuring that those policy prescripts that are there are adhered to the letter by your staff. It is not your challenge alone. All of us challenge as oversight bodies to correctly identify the areas of concern and to say, isolate them, say how to deal with them. So the issue around the need to bank collected money as timely as required is very important in terms of avoiding some of these issues around. Some of the documentation gets lost because maybe money has been misused. So you cannot keep documents for money that you cannot prove that was a big bank. So that area does need to be given sharp focus. Yes, you can continue.
Let me ask the final question on this issue, Chair, then we can allow other members to get involved. Your policy for recording the monies collected for immigration fines and penalties and all that type of stuff has been a problem and continues to be a problem. The AG this year is talking about 29 million rand that he can't give an opinion on because he doesn't have sufficient information on which to work. What are you doing about that? I'm asking that question because in your response you say the turnaround team is working on a program. This turnaround team has been in place for 2 years, as you see, probably 3 years. So are we getting to the bottom of this matter? Let's put it to you this way, accounting officer in the department. It's becoming more and more difficult for you to justify getting disclaimers year after year. And these matters are the matters that the AG, everything I spoke about today were the matters that the AG highlighted for his disclaimer. So unless you resolve them, we'll have another disclaimer next year and the year thereafter, and we're going to have a problem. So we know that there's historically been a problem with this. You put in a turnaround team to sort out your department. I think we need to put time frames to your turnaround teams to see that they themselves also have an incentive to finish their work. When are we going to resolve this thing about immigrant penalties? Money is not being able to reconcile or support documents. Or are you saying to us that this is going to be a problem as long as Home Affairs does its business in the manner that it does its business?
In the present environment, how the legislation is written is a problem regarding immigration fines. Because practically how it works is, when an irregularity from an Immigration Act point of view occurs, the immigration officer issues a fine. That fine is just a document. The next process, the person who the fine is levied to, the carrier or the individual, has a right to appeal that fine. Once they appeal the fine and the fine is upheld, then only they are liable to pay that fine. However, the payment of the fine only occurs when they come back into the country, not when they leave the country or anything like that. So that is, firstly, practically doesn't make sense, but that's the law. So until certain regulations or even the law is changed, we will have an issue like this. However, what we do account for is what we have received from those fines, where the carriers or the individuals pay for those fines at the border post, whichever one they enter into. So if the fine is issued at Bait Bridge, as an example, they can pay the fine at OR Tambo when they return, because in terms of our movement control system, it says that this individual is not allowed back into the country because there's a fine, there's an outstanding fine against that individual's name. Now, so in a nutshell, that problem is there until. What the turnaround team is addressing is, in terms of the Immigration Act, there are three revenue sources, one being fines, one being penalties, and the other being the permits and visas, the revenue around that. For each of those revenue streams, the immigration branch has a case file. Those case files are unique in number, and the supporting documentation, which for audit purpose would be like a receipt number, is basically that case file. And what we are trying to do is link back from the time an individual pays the fine to those cases. Because what we have is, you cannot even consider a debt until the occurring of an event. And those nuances need to be worked out within the department. What we are doing within the present environment, that is, as I described, not yet changed, is that we can only link it back to the case files when individuals transgress the law. So that's just a practical situation we're sitting with. Thank you.
Let me just understand this, and we'll ask Mr. Chauke to talk on the need to change legislation. Am I understanding you correctly to be saying that you raise the debt as a department? You only raise the debt when the immigrant or the guilty person comes back into the country, or are you raising the debt at the point where your official hands over the fine?
No, or neither. We raise the debt when the person is unsuccessful in their appeal, because before that, every fine is subject to appeal. So when the appeal is unsuccessful, then only can we raise the debt.
All right. Then the AG is saying to me that he's unable to pick up any document, or the audit trail is fuzzy. In other words, if I understand you, AG, it means that there's an amount in the book. We have no paperwork that says so-and-so appeal was unsuccessful, therefore he owes the Department of Home Affairs X amount of money. That's what I understand you to be saying. So it goes back to the supporting of whatever information you have in your documents. And you say you raise it when it's been unsuccessful. What documentation do you get to prove that Mr. X has been unsuccessful? And why can't the AG then use that piece of paper, whether it's a court order or a decision by some individual, to say, there's Mr. X, he was unsuccessful, and there's the amount that we're charging you for? Because I think that would suffice from an AG's point of view. You saying you do it on that point where the appeal has been lost. What documentation do you get to prove that the appeal has been lost, and what happens to that documentation after
documentation where the appeal has been lost is in the form of a resolution that the Refugee Appeal Board takes. And that resolution is the supporting documentation that the fine may be raised as a debt at that point.
I'm saying where's that resolution? Because the AG said he doesn't have it, or he was not given sight of those resolutions. Where can we find those resolutions?
Those resolutions are in case files that are sitting with the individual. My understanding of the process.
No. I think what you're saying is what is supposed to be. The resolution is supposed to be the case file, isn't it?
The resolution is a part of a document in a case file, yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's the conceptual part. We're dealing with the practical part. At the practical level, the AG is unable to find that documentation. I think that's the point we're at. We don't want an explanation about processes, what they look like. We deal with implementation or lack thereof. And the concrete question is, the AG's finding is that there is no adequate documentation. And I thought you would talk to that aspect. What, if I quote you well, what is it that you're doing to ensure that the documentation is kept, and when it's there, all its papers is found? Because the point here is that when auditing is done, documentation is not always found. That is the issue. So what we want to know is, what is it that that the department is doing to actually correct that situation? Because it's not enough to merely have processes and procedures. What must be done, how things should happen, and at the end of the day, they don't happen that way. What is it that you're doing to address that situation where there's no sufficient documentation for processes that happen in the department?
Thank you, Chair. There's two things that's being done. One is, in terms of documentation, I believe that the case files are there. However, I don't think in terms of a process that the understanding was there in terms of how to audit the penalties and the fines. From that point of view, as part of the turnaround that the member read, the filing system around each and every case file is being documented. But more so, not only the file, but each and every page within the file is being labeled, so that we can track, even if there's misfiling, we can track that. That's the one issue that's being done, specifically around on the turnaround.
Well, maybe let's do it this way. Is it correct that there is a problem with keeping documentation?
Yes, there is a problem that's being addressed.
How is it being addressed?
Well, like I said, from a turnaround perspective, each of the case files are being, there's two aspects to it. Each of the case files are being reviewed, and each page within that case file is being labeled so that we can track it. Then, that's the first part. The to-be future part would be when we go and scan these documents to put them on a database so that paper doesn't get lost. But that's still to come in the future.
Okay.
Before we ask the chair through you, some response on the need to change the legislation, just the overriding point that I want to make around control is that, and I'm looking from the management responses to questions that the AG would have raised before he finalized the report, I would imagine. And in many of your responses, you seem to have a different understanding of your requirements to the AG. And in many instances, particularly the treasury is in here, many Treasury needs to make a ruling. Let me give you an example. BAT and MSC systems were never designed to interface. As per a National Treasury ruling, the department is unable to make these changes to the system, and therefore BAT and MSC will not interface in the future. And therefore this problem, because this BAT and MCS we're talking about, presumably would resolve or go a long way to resolving this problem. But we're saying there's a ruling that Treasury has made that these two systems can't talk to each other, and as far as the management of home affairs is concerned, they're not going to talk to each other in the future. In simple language, Chair, what is they saying to us is that if this is part of the tool to fix up this problem, we will sit with this problem until Treasury changes its mind. Now, Treasury must tell us why they are dilly-dallying, or as parliamentarians we need to find a solution. But we can't have a situation where the Home Affairs Department is saying we can't resolve it because Treasury is dilly-dallying or Treasury doesn't agree. And in the meantime, the AG continues to look at it and give the disclaimer. It's unfair to you, it's unfair to other scopa. It's just not, it doesn't make sense. Do you stand by your responses? That as per National Treasury ruling, the department are unable to make any changes to the BAT system, and therefore BAT and MSC will not interface in the future. If you can't make those changes, they can't interface in the future. Are you going to find another solution, or are we going to continue to say, well, because we can't make these changes, tough, we're going to live with this problem? Are you standing by that? Because if we are, it means that we'll have to engage Treasury.
Chairperson member, if I can create the context, the movement control system, the MCA.
I think what is critical here is your confirmation of that statement. The one challenge I'm having, comrade, is that the Treasury is not here to also give us context, because we'll have your context and not have their context. If you say that statement is correct, because to me it does not make sense at all. And you recall that this week we had a similar situation where a departmental official was telling us that the Treasury rules are the problem because they are vague, they can't be implemented or correctly interpreted. So I wouldn't want a situation where in the absence of Treasury we're given an explanation that justifies why things will remain the way they are. Well, for me, it sounds so illogical. I would find it difficult that Treasury would give a ruling that actually ties you down from getting things right, unless there is an explanation that is not coming forth from your side on why that kind of decision has been taken. And we did have a similar situation, I think, with defense, where there are three systems that were not interfacing, and we're told no Treasury, this and that. So it will be very difficult. But it's a situation that is totally unacceptable. That we have systems that don't talk to each other, and Treasury say, keep it that way. I'm struggling to make sense out of it. Okay. Yes, Mr. Nadu? The movement control system, the short answer to it, the movement control system is not an accounting system. Hence, the interface to BAT is not allowed. So you can't age debt, you can only log fines on it. That's one of the fundamental reasons. Second reason is, given that BAT is going to be done away with and IFMS is coming, all changes to BAT are being restricted by Treasury. So what we had asked for is to get a pastel accounting system just to control this type of revenue that comes to our pools. You see, your explanation actually justifies why Treasury refused to situation where one is able to get things right. Now, maybe let's leave it at that.
Let me take this opportunity to greet and thank everybody present here. I'm going to deal with capital assets, and I've got three simple questions that I'll be posing to you. The AG noted that he was unable to verify the existence of an application valuation of capital assets of 663 million recorded in May 2024.
Comrade, can you throw the mic closer to you?
Okay. Recorded in May 2024 and 2025. What measures have been taken by the department to rectify the 392 million reflected in the asset register that could not be verified at various home offices across the country? Has the material number of assets acquired subsequent to the 1st of April 2002 been adequately recorded in line with Section 41A? Of the PFMA and Treasury Regulation 17.2.3. I would love to refer you to page 139, paragraph 8. The AG also notes that vehicles belonging to the department, government garage amounting to 4 million, were erroneously included in the department asset register. Has this error been rectified, and what measures have been implemented to prevent this from occurring in the current financial year? Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. If I can refer the committee members to page 134. In the accounting officer's report, where we talk about assets, on the second column under bullet point one, where we refer to the Auditor General's report in that 392 million rand. We have made significant progress in finding those assets, all of them, because what had happened during the year is when the audit was done, it was audited on work in progress. We had not finished our exercise. So in terms of when, by the time the audit was completed, we went and found all of these assets. The 125 million has been correctly classified. Initially, it was classified as work in progress. The 11 million rand was taken out. The 53 million rand CPI adjustment. Initially, we couldn't allocate it to an invoice because the invoice only said CPI adjustment. And it didn't refer.
Just a minute. Have you sorted it out?
Yes.
That's all we need.
Okay.
Yes, Gomez.
You are done. In terms of the second issue that the member raised, 2002 assets, the issue there is the documentation around assets acquired in that time period were misplaced, and that occurred when the department moved location from Civitas to where we are presently. In the absence of documentation, Treasury allows for a valuation exercise to be done for those assets, and that's what we did. Treasury Regulation 17.2.3 refers to the retaining of documentation.
Don't go that far. As this is getting rectified, that's the essence of the question. The associated the asset register, there was a query by the Auditor General subsequent to this audit. Has any measures been taken to reclass in the current situation? That's the essence of the question.
Yes, it has been done. There's two aspects to the question. The one aspect is if you don't have documentation, then you run foul of Treasury Regulation 17.2. However, Treasury does allow for the valuation exercise to be done where there is no supporting documentation. But the AG has to report non-compliance in terms of documentation that we do not have. So as long as we do not have the documentation, it will be non-compliance in terms of it. In the current year, all the assets that we have acquired, we do have that documentation, hence we don't have to do a valuation exercise. In terms of government garage vehicle, I can refer the committee members to page 134 as well, where we state that all those vehicles have been confirmed to belong to the department. It's at the bottom of page 134, bullet point 3. Thank you.
So you can just get clarity on that one thing. Yeah. The AG says those vehicles belong to government departments. Department says, no, we verify those vehicles actually belong to us and not to the government department. Therefore, it shouldn't have arisen in the first instance. That's what he's saying to us. AG, how does it happen that you give us information that should never have arisen in the first place?
Thank you. Through the chair, honourable member, when the audit of assets was done, the assets register as the department had given us, we took the assets register and we went and did a site inspection where we took down the registration numbers of the vehicles that were standing on the premises. When we did the cross-check of those registration numbers, it was not reflected on the assets, it was actually reflected as vehicles belonging to government garage. So that is from the point of where we actually got the audit evidence on it. And the department has then, subsequent to that, said no, there has been amendments done to the asset registry, etc., etc. But at the point when the audit was done, those were the findings, where those assets were not reflected as part of the assets on the asset registry, and actually reflected on the asset registry as assets that belong to the government garage.
Okay, no, we're satisfied with that. So we're saying that the asset register was not up to date when you did your audit, because they were reflecting as government assets when in fact they were assets for the department. maybe the question that we should pose to the department is how up to date is the accurate register today as we speak? Are there still assets that are yours that are reflected as assets belonging to other national departments?
No, they aren't. The asset register is up to date in terms of, we still have to do an existence exercise. Obviously, that gets done annually. So the asset register as at the 31st of March 2008 is up to date. The acquisition made during the year have been done, but we still have to do the existence exercise to account for the movement thereof. But that is done. Thanks.
I think that's not enough. I mean, one step touched, because I'm sure it is progress, because this can lead to sort of what one is referred, yet I'm referring wrongly to the theft or corruption or to some of the things. Why do I say that? Even you had resigned immediately the day before yesterday or whenever, because everyone can walk and go wherever you are. And the following year, or when someone comes and takes over DG and you, we are going to get this statement. And then how will it be answered? Because I would expect you, after you have realized that the asset register was not adjusted or was not done, there was some error, clerical error, or whatever, to write back to the auditor or phone auditor and say, please. Item so and so, which we have done this and this, it has been rectified. Here it is. Now I'm concerned if we can accept it and let it go like that.
We did do that. And part of our exercise was actually to even ask for an extension period for the month of August. But the Auditor General believed that they couldn't just audit corrections, they would rather have to audit the complete asset base again. So it was that the corrections were tabled to the auditors once we had corrected them. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Great.
I view non-compliance very seriously. Even though it's written as an emphasis of matter, personally, that's my view, because it's non-compliance with legislation. The root cause to non-compliance is twofold within the department. One is that there's a base lack of understanding and knowledge and skills within the department. The second is discipline.
I'm not sure. I mean, how do you employ people who do not have knowledge and skills?
It's
very serious. How do we employ people, and after employing them, say, people have no knowledge, have no skills?
It is something that we found in the department. Because compliance is, on PFMA, on treasury regulations, even on the PSA, is a hallmark character of every civil servant within government, because the rules apply to all of us. And then,
so are you suggesting that you came into a department where incompetent people have been employed?
Just on that particular one, there are indeed instances of that. We had the support intervention team coming in and do an assessment of the competence of members of the department. I wouldn't say specifically to the issue raised here, exclusively to that, but a number of people failed their competency tests, were found to be not suited to be in the position that they occupy. It's a report that's available.
What percentage of your employees failed the competency test?
The test was carried out among senior management service members. At the level of director, chief director, and higher, I don't have the percentage, but more than 50% for sure did not meet the requirements of the competence test.
So essentially, all these troubles that we had could principally be attributed to the fact that when competent people employed, given responsibilities that they cannot discharge.
I would think, Chair, it's a broad question, but it's a consequence of a number of things. And certainly, that's one of them. But also, I think overall management of people would contribute to these kinds of things. It's a matter that is not
I think so far the levels at which the competence test has been done appears to be more at management level. So I'm starting right there, that if you have people who have been made managers, who have been given responsibility, are not competent. Certainly, even if you have competent junior staff, but because they are being led by incompetent people, they are not going to be that productive. Optimally productive. Because, you see, in everything that we were doing in the department, you can have the systems, you can have the policies and procedures, the human factor is the deciding factor. But if your human capital is not competent, is not sufficiently competent, you can have all the latest gadgets in your office. They'll come to naught, because the people who are supposed to mend them, utilize them, will not be able to utilize them effectively. And if you check the report of the Auditor General, when it comes to control activities, I think COVID has talked to that in terms of, documentation. The control environment, it talks to a lack of appropriate policies and procedures. But it seems to be suggesting that, some of these things have been addressed or are being addressed. But most importantly, which talks to this question of skills, management or monitoring data, it's not auto monitor. So for as long as we have people who are inefficient, it means that during the turnaround team, it will come and go, leave the responsibilities in the hands of incompetent people. Things will just collapse. That would be my understanding. And for me, we can leave everything else. People can deal with that alone. That is what can turn things around. And not the consultants that are all over the department. I would be interested to hear how, having realized that there are these challenges of competence, what is it that you have done or that you are doing to address that question, so that you have people who are competent, properly motivated, properly focused, managing the department.
Thank you, Chair. You're absolutely correct to say that is the biggest element of our challenge. The changes, the transformation that's taking place in the department indeed revolves around trying to get people who can have sufficient levels of competence and management skills to be able to carry out the tasks that they get hired to carry out. We are dealing with a situation in which we have a very set, rather elaborate, time-consuming procedures to get the situation to be corrected. We are migrating people from the old structure into the new one. We are relooking at the competence of the people and matching them to the requirements of the new positions. But if the people are found not to be suitable, our obligation is to create conditions for them in time through training so that they can be able to fulfill this task. The Senior Management Service Handbook and indeed the Labor Relations Act is very clear on what one does to get a person to be able to perform appropriately. That is the challenge that we are facing right now, and that is what we're embarking on. We have had a situation in which, we have a situation currently in which we are asking people to, we're redefining jobs. It was found necessary to move to a new structure. Sorry, I don't want to talk about structure. Structure is defined by the functions that need to be carried out. And people have not just moved willy-nilly across into the structure. Where the job of the person changes substantially, 50+1, that person has to reapply for the position. And that is what we are doing right now. Where they fall short, we are putting in place programs to train them. We put others that will be in holding positions. But before you can get to a situation where you have the person you need, either by training these people or getting in new ones, you have to go through those processes. That's what we're doing now, Chair.
So can we say that going forward, maybe Comrade Jauke can take this forward, say that the key area of focus is on the quality of the personnel that we have. For as long as that is not addressed decisively and firmly, things will just remain safe. I've spoken about the human factor that is divisive. Now, turnaround team that we're having, how much does it cost the department to handle? And for how long is it still supposed to be in the department? How long is your contract?
The turnaround team is expected to be around for 3 years, starting about in June 2007. The cost to date, the cost breakdown for their services is 146 million, 146.022 million, and the total expenditure, plus 196,000. Can I ask my colleague to read it?
The turnaround began in May 2007, and the initial contract was amended in December 2007. That's where the 146 million came from. The present contract is from December 2007 to December 2009, so it's a two-year contract. Treasury has put in on our budget for 3 years, this year being the first year, 300 million for each year set aside. I think in the last year it's sitting at 320 million. In the current year, the expenditure is 196 million on the turnaround.
196?
In the current year, yeah. But the money budgeted is about 900 million. Over 3 years. Just over 900 million, yeah.
Sure, over 3 years. Now, I'm looking at that expenditure of 196 million and then looking at the report that we're having. If what we're having is what 196 million can buy, what would we be having in the absence of the turnaround? What worst thing could have happened if the turnaround where's that, what we're heading now?
I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. They were not brought in specifically to train people, but to be involved in a wide range of things, including re-engineering the processes of producing things. Training is definitely one of the things that we would do, that they are assigned to do. But it's a starting point, right? People start off by looking at the existing situation and doing extensive developing strategies to address those situations. If we're talking about the training of people, it is unfortunately a rather protracted thing that we won't be able to achieve overnight. We're still struggling right now to put people into the new structure simply because the processes of getting there, and they have nothing to do with the consultants, they have to do with civil service requirements, that when you make fundamental changes as are being made, you need to follow certain procedures which are approved or confirmed by the Department of Public Service and Administration.
I understand that part. I think my question is, the report of the department is a disclaimer. We have a vacancy rate of what is the vacancy rate we're having?
29.1.
Yeah, 29.1. That is the vacancy rate in the department. What I'm saying is that we have this turnaround team that we're paying. For this year, we paid 196 million.
logical suggestion that if the turnaround team was not there, we could have got something worse than this. I'm merely giving an opportunity to say, this is the value we're driving from this turnaround team. These are the improvements that we've seen in our system that justifies this amount of money.
Chair, we would have to look at the totality of the work that's being done in the turnaround effort. The actual addressing issues of financial management and control only started. There wasn't even a work stream that dealt with that mistake, perhaps, until October last year, when we hired the acting CFO. We then started developing strategies for dealing with the issues that were raised. Up to then, we've been dealing with people who have been part of the years of the problems that we're talking about. But what the turnaround team has been able to do must really be measured in very concrete terms on in areas where we have had very visible improvements. So it's unfortunate that we have not been able to get beyond the disclaimer. Very disappointing indeed. But it would be, I think we should not close our eyes to the fact that there are very many significant improvements that have been noticed by the population in general in terms of service delivery where the department is concerned. And those are some of the areas where of application for the turnaround effort. I'm saying the juxtaposition of one
idea. Are you suggesting, TJ, that the areas of financial management, because they happen in office, unlike service delivery where no queues are seen and you get extensive media coverage, that these matters were not given priority? Is that supposed to be my understanding?
Which matters are not given priority?
The issues of financial management.
I'm saying the issues of financial management started with the scoping. The turnaround team started with the scoping from June to around October, but it's only when Mr. Naidu joined us that we started addressing in earnest effectively issues that had been raised in previous audits.
Thank you, Chair. There's a lot of questions later on if I may, but I just want to know, this turnaround team, who does that consist of, if you have to talk about warm bodies?
Honourable Member, it's a combination of a team called Fever 380 Kani. That's the name of the company who is doing the turnaround.
Please explain to me, because we've had so many turnaround strategies that people are getting drunk turning around. If you can explain to me, this company, I didn't get the name, how many people is involved? Because I need to just get my figures balanced.
That's right. The name is Fever 380 Kani. 80 Kani were the consultants who were involved in the South turnaround as well. That's the company involved in the Home Affairs turnaround. The 80 Kani is the foreign consultant. Fever 380 is the local branch of 80 Kani. In terms of numbers of consultants, that fluctuates. It started off as low as 10, and at one time it went as high as 170 within the department. But it's given over the period of time, it's not a fixed number. It's when, as and when the need arises. Thank you.
done, Comrade P?
Yeah.
Comrade Sid?
Yeah. Thank you, Sir President. You are saying 50% of your staff is incompetent. I've just heard you say the acting CFO, which means this person is occupying two positions. I just want to find out from you how many of these acting CFOs are there, the deputy director general and the director. Because this could be the contributor to this incompetency that you're talking about. People acting as the expert.
Thank you, honorable member. The acting CFO is still acting because the incumbent still going through a disciplinary hearing. The disciplinary hearing is managed, is administered by an independent labor commissioner, and the department is unable to influence the pace of its proceedings. So we have had that case going on now for more than a year, unfortunately to all of us, but until that's resolved, we cannot fill the position. We have only one DDG who is not acting at the moment. In the area of immigration, the immigration.
DG. How many DDGs are acting? We know there is one who is not acting. How many are acting?
The rest of them are accepted for.
How many are they?
Chair, in the current structure, it's three. In the new structure, it will be more. But we haven't been able to fill the new structure because of...
How many will they be in the new structure?
Six.
All right. Then I think the question is adequately responded to. Now, your vacancy rate of 29.1%, at what levels are they? Is the vacancy rate higher?
It's highest in the management ranks, among the management ranks. What we did was to identify, we have a constraint about filling positions. Until the structure was approved, we could not fill certain, most of the positions. But we recognized that there were certain very key, critical positions where we moved ahead and filled them. But many of the vacancies are as a consequence of the rather slow and cumbersome restructuring that's taking place.
So is it so that the turnaround team actually fulfills some of its management responsibilities or tasks?
No, that is not the case. What we did was to arrange for short-term so-called management leadership support teams. People to handhold persons in the department, either who are going to take those positions, or to act indeed and carry out some of these things. Not the consultants from Fever 3 and ATCANI, but short-term people to carry out the work until we can fill the positions.
Practically, what does the turnaround team do? Go there, occupy offices from 8 to 4, do they produce documents on how things must be done or what must be done?
team is involved in a number of things. They had a specialist in logistics who assisted with looking at how to process more efficiently, for instance, the production of IDs. So that team looked at how that should be shortened, and that's been achieved. They have a person who they got involved in looking at contracts. We had very many contracts which were incomplete or not being observed, or we had transactions which were not contracted. They assisted in reviewing those contracts and putting in place service level agreements. They, having looked at the service delivery area, they studied why there are such long queues in the various offices and found that, in fact, there were certain reasons which brought people to the lines which could be and proposed that we create, for instance, alternative places where information could be got. About 40%, for instance, of people queuing in lines in the offices go there to find information, not to get a document. So alternative strategies were proposed for that, such as the implementation of a call center, a contact center, which has diverted some of the people. That's part of what they've been doing. We have about 53 projects which are in this report where the turnaround people are actively involved, working, using their expertise, but structured in such a way that they work hand-in-hand with a person from the department. On page 127 of the report, we have the areas where the turnaround activities have been taking place, and the turnaround teams, the Fever Tree people, have been involved in these. We would like to convey the message that the turnaround is a joint effort. It's actually driven within the department, and we deploy these people to use their expertise in the areas that are identified jointly by all of us.
Might be thought
trying to see the rocket science in some of the things that they are doing. Take us back to the third question of the personnel that we're having. Yes.
Can I just ask you on that issue? One of the things that we identified at the beginning was the problem between the internal control, the capacity of the government to deal with issues of politics. And I think that area is one of the weakest areas. That is why we have all of the systems. We look at the system as allowed the political control. And the call that we made with really not get favor as a committee was that, you know, we're calling upon the system. Understand each other as a person at that point. So they interpreted the call that was made by committee system, saying that Treasury must come and take over the running of the system. We have not said that. It was on the basis of how the groups had raised the challenge that we were requesting, not a mass, but Treasury should help the department create that capacity for it to be able to deal with the challenge. Part of what you hear when they give the report was clearly that there are problems of capacity within the community. As much as the DG tries to get the discipline in terms, they themselves do not have capacity to some operations that are considered through our institution. Therefore, we made a second call to say the Department of Public Service should help the department, take over the department, for it to be able to create the capacity. So that, you know, we don't come back tomorrow with a situation of over 50% of and back to the we have only one DG full time. The rest of them are equal. Clearly for me is that if you have a situation, you're not guaranteed. People may leave any time to go. The fever tree will be there today, the next year, when they leave, what capacity are they created for the department to be able to move forward. Because you don't have an understanding that says capacity is being built as much as the thing there, this is what we are creating. We are putting in place staff to be able to take over when the give us to me. My concern of the top of the committee is that when they leave, things are going to collapse. Things are going to collapse and will not be able, you know, to get people that would move to the department. That's not the concern that we're having. And I think people sort of understand this is the committee is advocating for the takeover. We don't think that it's a concern that we're raising. And the recommendations that we put forward are not in, you know, in a manner of undermining the work that is being done by the industry. It's because we say that we'll be going to the third community. And we don't want to do that. But if it's rejected, Parliament will fight on the better. The problem is that, you know, when you cannot account for some of these things, well, we are very lenient in our code when we don't have a system. You know, by law, people left in time for treating or tax or account for half the money. And also, the new plan approach, something that says in that flight approach, let us work together to understand. I am a certain person of the when it came into the department, in and all the
Okay, thank you very much. Well, the last aspect that I want to check, DG, you recall that in our last engagement we spoke about Lindela and we are supposed to go and renegotiate the contract. Can you give us some feedback on that?
Thank you, Chair. We have a report which the acting CFO will kindly read.
Thank you. Honourable members, in terms of Lindela, we had renegotiated an amendment to the contract was signed on the 1st of February 2008. That amendment put the department in a position to save 640,000 rand per month for the duration of the life of the contract. The contract that we negotiated began in 2005. It's a 10-year contract, and we are now
we know that part.
Okay.
What's supposed to happen to renegotiate the tariff? All we're interested in it. What has been the outcome of those negotiations?
We have renegotiated tariffs. The outcome is a saving of 7.2 million rand per annum for the life of the contract over the next 7 years. Per year.
Help us, because we understand the context of our last discussion.
Chair, in the last discussion, the concern of the honourable members and indeed of other people watching the situation was that the accounting for the persons held at Lindela was based on a fixed number, and that as a result of that, whether there were much fewer people or not, the department found itself paying a flat amount of money. So we went back to renegotiate that and try to get the costing based on the individual. After a lot of discussions, it was agreed that because that facility was custom built for the department, the best way to handle the accounting for the costing for the services that Busasa rendered was, as indicated in the report, which I understand was made available to the committee, and in that we realized the saving that has been referred to, Chair.
Yeah, I thought you would still talk to the detail in terms of, because in the past there was a fixed number for which the department was charged irrespective, and that was at a particular level. So what is it that you have read about? For me, those are the details that are not coming through. So initially, this was a fixed number. We've renegotiated it. It's come down to this level. It's come up to this level. Or the charge per inmate has been reduced from this amount to that amount, which then leads to a saving of this amount. Because to merely say we're saving so many million without the base of where it comes from does not tell us much.
Thanks, Chair. As a result of the renegotiations, it was agreed that the monthly fee would be based on a current daily tariff of 95.37 rand per person per day, fixed at an average minimum of 2,500 persons per day in any given month. For example, so 2,500.
Can I just check what is new in this figure, different from what we had previously?
We had 3,500, 3,200.
So the difference of having the reduction on the threshold number from 3,250 to 2,500.
One of them,
Chair. Right, that is one.
The variable cost for food will be applicable only when the number of illegal immigrants held at a detention facility exceeds 2,500 and shall be, as indicated, from 2,500 to 3,250, it would be 13 rand. From 3,250 and above, it would be 11 rand. That's a new thing. Provision of medical facilities and services is not part of the variation contained in this second addendum, and it will be subject to a separate agreement.
All right, no, that's fine. That's something that the portfolio committee can take board and discuss with you. Not having been part of the negotiation.
In terms of the budget, the sufficient budget within the what is called RAMP, the repairs and maintenance program, to actually cover those areas. But predominantly, what I'd like to stress is that it's not a value tender that says, when I issue this tender, you will have X amount of value. It'll be done on a case-by-case situation to say, to create a panel of vendors first, and then to create orders per vendor when we need an office to be refurbished. Because this is a protracted plan that we intend to do. Currently, Home Affairs has got 518 points of presence. That does not mean to say it's 518 offices, because it includes MPCCs and things of that nature. For that reason, we're not putting terminal seating in an MPCC as an example. It's a community facility that we won't refurbish. But our offices, that where we lease either from DPW or through a landlord, those offices will be refurbished. I'm guessing, but it's probably in the region.
Why should you guess?
But I don't have the figures in front of me at the moment. So for the terminal seating, it's in the region of 20 million. For the front office redesign in terms of the furniture, the counters, and the consoles, that's in the region of about 15 to 20 million. In terms of the specific office redesign, those are ranged between just above 500 to about 1.5 million, depending on which office we're talking about. Okay, all right, thank you.
Right, DG, thank you very much. But I do see that your CEO for government treating West is not here.
Yeah, my apologies, Chair. I should have apologized on his behalf. He's very unwell. That's why he's not here.
All right. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think last time when we were in the house, I was referring to the chamber and telling them how important the Home Affairs and dig on that point. I think all over the world, Home Affairs one of the top five or top three in government. It's a very important department. We have to take it seriously. Especially nowadays when you give census and you want to go for elections. Home Affairs deals with our IDs, deals with death, marriage, you know, to identify every person in this country where he belongs to and all of them, then we have to take it very seriously on that. Now, one just wonders, now is for the third time we talk about disclaimer, emphasis of matter, and other matters. I just want to ask you a few, just one question or two questions. Why go to printing works and reading with printing works? DG, if you can tell me, I have picked up somewhere here. I think previously, the DG, starting from 2002 to 2004, the DG resigned one April 2003. The second DG came in on June 2004. The first one, if I'm correct, which surprised me, is due on May 2007. What happened between the time? Were there any DGs employed before that time? Let's say between 2006 up to May 2007. Or were they acting?
I'm not very familiar with the history, but I do know that I came in, there was a DG who resigned in 2006, I think.
this is a problem that I'm having because the health, I'm saying, this is in border department. Really, if we can have DG, it's only taking 1 year, and then the following year we have got another DG. Yet we have got the same, and we're going to have no problem. Now, I see when coming to the government bringing work, the CEO is not around, but you had acting FCO. Is acting. CFO. Now, this guy, what surprises me, he acts with an amount of close to 1,398 per hour. Now it means he's well above 246,000 a month, which comes to plus and minus 3 million a year. It sounds ridiculous. Then we have got his claim. Or access, we have got access on government printing. How does it sound? Is it okay? Or is that how you pay your CFO? Or is it because you have been contracted?
Yeah, maybe let's do this comment if you can. I see here that his contract, if I call it right, is from July this year to December this year. So July, August, September, October, November, December. 6 months. I have it right. So it's a 6 month contract. Which is worth 1.something million.
That's what I'm referring to, 246,000 a month.
Why is it 6 month contract? What is supposed to be achieved or within this 6 months? Just trying to check what was the rationale or the basis for having the contract structured as it is.
We have a situation, honorable members, where we do not find CFOs who would be willing to take a position in a organization like a GPW at the normal DDG level of salary. And so part of what and the organization has been getting disclaimers or adverse opinions, there has been a need to get somebody in until such time that we can get who we want. I think part of the problem at GPW is that CFO there is at a level that's a chief director level. And it's not been easy to attract a person who would be willing to do that job.
December is only after next week. So have you found a replacement yet?
No, we haven't found a replacement yet. Yeah. There is a request that the position be re-evaluated to replace at DDG level.
So, but in relation to this contract, this one is definitely going to be renewed come end of December because you do not have anybody yet.
I don't know, Jeff.
We don't have anybody who knows you, so you may not be in a position to talk to this issue.
I would hope that short, if we can't place a person, then we'd have to continue with the short-term arrangement. I did not consult with the CEO to find out how. didn't find somebody, would either have to continue with this arrangement or find another short-term arrangement. Chair Lechichauke mentioned, among other things, that part of the problem we have is that people don't really, it's not easy to find people who would volunteer, who would want to go and work for a department like Home Affairs or GPW, given the nature of the task that needs to be done there at the levels that are offered by the civil service. It is a real problem.
Okay. Thank you. I think there's nothing that we can do, Chair. I think one can even support if they are thinking of changing the pickups and then we have the person who can be permanent. Because the country is not like this. I was looking at what happened when you arrived here almost a year ago. With two disclaimers on the following year, that thinking that you can rectify those and then start with your job again. That's why you repeat the same disclaimer. I mean, it's a problem, that's what I'm saying. This department is the highest department in government structure. It is on top three, the whole world. And then really, if you play with this, I mean, I'm having a problem. I will still support if there is for the problem of getting people to be paid high. I was looking, I didn't go so far because you can see we are only four or five dealing with more than 500 departments and all of that and sharing this time. That's why we get worried when people, when we get claim or we get adverts, we get qualifications, and then it takes us back to go through the books and find out. We are supposed to have started year 1995 to check these books, but because we only started to go through them last night, we couldn't go so far. But I started from only 2005, 6, 2006, 7, 2007, 8. Looking at human law on employment, in 2005 and 6 on human resource, we budgeted for 1,004. You only employed 570, and there was vacancy for 434, which meant 43%. In 2006 and 7, we gave you a budget covering 1,037. Only 579 were employed, with vacancies of 458. That is 44%. In 2007 and 8, out of 1,038, 562, you only employed 400, and I mean you did a vacancy for 476. It means 46%. It's not only Home Affairs. We went through all the departments. Now we haven't got the manpower, but what we wanted to do, we want to collate from 1994 up to now in scope, and find how much have we budgeted and how many millions of people were supposed to have been employed and the money sitting there. And all the entities outside here, the labor is arguing, everybody is arguing, saying that we have got big unemployment. Yet we have got these problems that are still being carried on and on and on and on. The money is there. This is the problem to us. Maybe you can summarize that when you answer.
Okay.
was appointed that his contract fell out any specific deliverance in these 6 months. Have we said we are appointing you so that you have an unqualified report? So are there any deliverables? And then secondly, could you give us Mr. Barnard's qualification? Bookkeeper, that type of thing. And I'm asking those questions because we have an indication from the Auditor General what the going rate is for CAs and that type of thing. So I just need to understand the qualifications so that we could indicate to you whether we think you're overpaying, underpaying, you're within the ballpark figure around the rate. And then secondly, what are the deliverables? For 1.5 million rand for the 6 months, what are we buying? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again,
I must really apologize. Normally, GPW is fairly autonomous and they are represented normally by their CEO and CFO. And we're not quite sure whether they would be asked to appear today, and we might have done more homework on some of these things. But the person in question is here, and I hope it wouldn't be embarrassing to pass the question to him and ask him to answer some of these questions. Just want to say that the amount indicated there isn't, it does not, the money doesn't all go to him. It some of it goes to the sourcing company.
Let's do this, TJ. I think the two questions can definitely be answered. What are the deliverables? The contract. What is it supposed to deliver in 6 months? And the question of qualification. I don't think it's too invasive to the personal, you know, base. What are the deliverables? What are you supposed to deliver in 6 months? And seeing that we are in the 5th month, how far are we in achieving what you had agreed upon in the contract?
Thank you, Jeff. As far as can I just go back to the first question? The first question was one of the honourable member asked if I am a chartered accountant. As far as the second one, there was a specific performance contract signed. That performance contract also didn't just look at the 6 months, but also look beyond the 6 months. Because if there was an incumbent coming in, you had to continue with the deliverables as is. But they are to do deliverables. There is a signed contract. And there is progress reports being done on a weekly basis, as well as a weekly basis, on a summary basis, and monthly basis as well.
Yeah, but what is it that you're supposed to deliver? Specific.
Like I said, there's a specific contract. That contract I've mentioned, I don't know the details, but the specific items of the auditor's report are in there. There's also more items in there as far as the turnaround of GPW is concerned. So if there are the issues raised by the auditor general, if there's issues raised by SCOPA or any other body, and they are all in there.
No, so that's fine. You know, my only difficulty that I have with that is that I don't have a difficulty with the contract. The difficulty I have with the logic that is worrying me, that this contract expires in December. Part of this contract is to turn this department around in terms of scope of report and agent report. That will only be made public, or it will only come to light in August next year. In August next year. Mr. Barnard could well have had his contract terminated, told not to come back, and all those good things. Now, you see what my difficulty is, we said we'll pay you on condition you do X. But the report card will come out after his contract has expired, and there probably would be no recourse for the money. In other words, if you didn't deliver, the only the only record that I will have that you will have delivered is the Auditor General's report. Now that report AG will probably come out with September? Yeah. So it's almost a year after the incumbent has left. Being the nasty person that I am, I would say that you should keep some sort of a retention. So that if he doesn't deliver, at least the money to us, I'm saying probably doesn't, we couldn't do that in this contract. But I'm saying, I mean, if it was my money, surely there would be something that says, well, you know, I'm not going to give you all the money until I'm satisfied that you deliver on your contract. But how do we have a contract that expires? A contract that expires in December, the deliverables are only there 2 or 3 months, or even a year later. And then what recourse do we have? Because if it doesn't, then I'm suggesting we're going to have a case of unauthorized, irregular, or whatever expenditure, because we wouldn't have delivered the contract. Has the department thought about it? And if you haven't thought about that, I'm suggesting you go think about it and renegotiate that contract. You can't have a contract that says he's going to deliver on the AGO scope of report and allow him to leave before that report is made public, because then he's still making nonsense. So unless I'm understanding it incorrectly, then it makes nonsense of the contract, because he wouldn't be around when the Auditor General's report is made public. I hope I'm making sense, Chairperson. If I'm totally missing it, please bring me back in line. But it doesn't make sense the way you're doing it.
Yeah, no. It makes perfect sense to me, and I think our handicap is the absence of the CEO, so that we're able to get the logic of the way things have been done. I don't see how within 6 months you can have that turnaround. But that's what we're having. Committee, did you have? Yeah, we waiting for land back. It appears that the portfolio committee is taking longer than we had agreed upon. Now 35 million beyond what we had agreed that land back should be here. Okay, understand they are coming. So can we wrap up this one so that we can comment? Yeah.
Yes, I think by asking that question, I know maybe to tell all that they can of wealth, and then it touches a lot of things. Maybe with DG, we should need a timer. Why I'm saying that, Google brother, he over the day. I think we need to have some 3 months progress report. Not paralyzing you, so that we can go through with you and try to find out if have we now changed the figure of employment up to this? Have we done this on ABC? How can we do it within the next coming 6 months? Because really we are helpless, let's go. We are dealing with the things which has happened in 2007 and 2008 that they are part. I mean, here is the claim of 2004-05. Here is the claim of 2005-06. Here is the claim of 2007-08. We come after this has happened. Now, I don't know how can we fish it so that we can be with you and have help on. Instead of blaming you, we should blame all of us. We should, I mean, take that blame. And say, fine, we evolved from the start and we tried ABC, it couldn't work. I don't know how can we really deal with that. I think you might have been arguing on that, leaving to our own ranks. I don't know how can we deal with this. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Now, Jay, something we raised at our last hearing with the department, and there is a gentleman here from the Fungi Group, so I can take the issue up, I suppose. But, Jay, we came out very negative to the possible corporatization of government printing. And I haven't been persuaded by left to decompose something again. It's just an impossible talk. And we've got examples of things that have been corporatized, from trading accounts to a corporatized government component, and they don't work well because you've got less controls and you've got less effect over them. But in the annual report on page 113, it speaks about the transformation of the printing work, including corporatization. And I fail to be convinced of what's standing here. For instance, I say here on page 114, the preliminary analysis therefore indicates that a feasible business case can be made for the conversion of printing works to a government component business entity. You see, government printing works is not supposed to make money. I don't know why everybody wants to make make business models and make money. It's supposed to, if there's money left, then it's all surplus, but we're not supposed to make profit with these entities. And if they do want to at least jack up the cash flow, last time we asked them for the outstanding debt that they are being owed by the provinces and the departments, and there was more than 100 million rand that were owed to you by state departments and provincial departments, and I don't think you need to be a chopper pilot to get that money back. And I mean, even if you take a thing like the tender bulletin, I mean, this thing, I showed it last time again, it costs 34 and 20. You get once a week, you get this, mailed all over the world. And I mean, these things, you don't even get them in CNA. You have to go and mail them. So you're losing on the stuff. But I mean, nobody's described it's been like this for decades. And there are many other indications. So I fail to be convinced that corporatization is the way to go with printing work. And I, the little devil on my shoulder is telling me, I just asked the question. The fact that you can't get somebody to fill the post, isn't that just maybe the fact that that position is being parked until you corporatize? And that's also unfair to us as a government that kind of practice is happening. And I cannot believe that government printing work in the past worked very well, very well. And I don't buy the argument that people are not prepared to come and work for X amount of money. It's just silly. Seriously. Thanks.
Thank you, Colin Pierre. I think once again, the constraint in terms of detailed responses will be the fact that the CEO is here, but I hope PG has the concern that have been raised that the government printing work will need to work on it would appear. I don't know whether it's the turnaround team that is at home affairs does interface with the government printing work, or that this is also part of the package. Okay. Yeah. So it's to change the situation for the better. Thank you very much, TG. We remain hopeful. Change for the better should improve so that the department is able to provide the services that it's supposed to and manage the resources of the state in line with legislation and regulation, following the procedures that are applicable. We remain hopeful that
thank you, Chair. It is our desire, too, that we get to that stage. Your frustrations are ours, too, that we have to work within certain systems which would like to straighten. But we thank you, first of all.
less than a minute.
Thank you.
last time we met, you were wearing a different hat. And here you are today, complete makeover. But nonetheless, welcome. Wish to welcome you, the acting CEO of the Hat Event, and your team. We also want to welcome the Minister of Land Affairs and Agriculture. Welcome, Complete Minister. Very much. We value that support. It's a great deal. If you could introduce your team, and then we'll kick straight to touch. Thank you, sir. I would like to introduce you to the team, as you said, and if you will allow me, just make some introductory remarks.
No, they introduce the team.
Thank you, sir. Chair, I'm Herman von Schalbeck. I'm the acting chair of the board. And I will start on my far left. That is Mr. Vincent Potwane, who's the treasurer. And next to him is Mr. Jaco du Plessis, he's the interim CFO. Next to him is Mr. Lani Lambrecht, he's the head of a cleanup team. And then, of course, Mr. Pakamani Hadebe, the interim CEO. And then on my right, we have Mr. Joe Mutumine, he's the chair of the audit committee. And then next to him, Mr. Musa Mutuna, the head of operations and communications.
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, I would once again like to welcome you, Mr. Chairperson, the chairman of the board, CEO, and your delegation. We obviously want to do things slightly different. We try to engage during the course of time, but would want to do it the normal and usual style. But in case in the course of the interaction or at the end of the chairman and the CEO feel there are things that you would want to put across and you have not been able to have that opportunity, you always have the time to do so. The only challenge we have is the commodity of time. This being a Friday and being the last day of the sitting of Parliament, but we will nonetheless try and make the best use of the time at our disposal. Committee.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, maybe just to start, one would like to get an indication of who of the seven people sitting there have been at Land Bank before, so that we can know who we can really ask questions to and how long have been there.
Chair, that's why we're a team here. Depending on the questions at our post, we will see who is best suited to answer the question.
I think the answer is we know there have been changes in the Land Bank. Are you all new, or are the people who have been there all along?
Chair, we're all new.
Thank you.
Okay, Chair, then that's fine. So I'd like to go to the minutes of last year. Any one of you have a copy of the minutes of this hearing of last year? Okay. Now, last year, on page 38 of the minutes, the CEO, Dr. what's his name? Yeah. Mr. Zaltaka said that he is on sick leave, and I was just wondering, do you have a system at Land Bank that if senior officials are sick, that they give a sick certificate from a doctor and you have them filed?
Yes, we do.
Well, then can you maybe that the hearing that we had for that day supply this committee with the medical of the doctor for the day not being here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have it. Yes, we do. That's a fair concern. But the problem is that the Land Bank, the consultants, they've had to reach a certain level of duration that it was very, very difficult to pick up all these documents. Chair, that is why we thought maybe you could begin.
So it might as well be so that
we
it might not be there.
Yes, so it's a cleanup team.
That's fine. I think all that the COVID is trying to do is, if that is a system that you have at a conceptual level, if indeed it was implemented, isn't there, can you check it? If it's not there because of the breakdown that was there, what you say is not there, I think that's really the
question.
Okay.
Thank you. And the last question from the minute, it says here by the CFO, then, says we asked a question about the people doing the turnaround strategy there. And then he answers, well, the people are still in the bank right now, and I think we've paid them at the moment about 4 million rand, but that's the payment that has gone out. I mean, there may be invoices that haven't come through. Could you just give us the situation with that contract? Is there still people like that in the bank at the moment, and how much is that costing them?
There are no people, Jeff. The turnaround strategy that I hope we'll be talking about here is the turnaround strategy that was done by the staff of the Land Bank with the help and assistance from the Department of Finance and Department of Agriculture and Land Affairs.
So what happened to that one that was paid more than 4 million rand?
We have a turnaround strategy, but the Land Bank has had 3 turnaround strategies in the past 4 years. And we looked at those turnaround strategies, but the worst part of it, or where they are lacking, is that they are not putting emphasis on development per se. And we felt that we needed to review the position in line with the government policy and the mandate of the government. So that is what we did.
Thanks, Jay. Could you maybe tell us how many people do you have on suspension at the moment that are being paid while they are on suspension?
We have had a number of people that have been in suspension over the past 2 years. Is roughly, I'll give you the number, Jay.
The one was dismissed 1st of November last year, and he was paid right up to the 10th of March, 458,000. The one was dismissed 8th of November. Also, this thing was finalized 31 March, which paid 394,000. Another one also 8th November, dismissed, finalized 31 March, paid 450,000. Then one was 7th November.
Outcome should have come after date of finalization. So you have suspension on the 12th of December 2003, and then the case was finalized on the 12th of August 2007. So it has date of suspension, it has outcome, and then a date of finalization. I think everybody should draw attention to that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. If you look at the last one, the dismissal number 8, it's got the same paper. For instance, he was dismissed, the person, 28 February this year, and it was finalized 17 June. That's 3.67 months. That's 401,000. So if people earning more than 100,000, what were these people doing? What positions did these 10 people have?
Thank you, Chair. I will just look around. Okay. The people. Okay, I could start with me. If I could start with the names, we have one up until 16, like you have already indicated. The majority of these people are senior people. That is the head of division and GF and head of IT and operations and CFO and all have senior positions. So they are senior management people. Thank you, James. So I'd like to move on to your properties in possession. How many properties you have in possession that you have repossessed because of people that can't pay?
Okay.
We have 26 properties in possession. That's the value, the market value of about 80-90 million or so. And those properties, the people that have made an interest on those 26 properties, is that we are hoping to sell to. Seven is development. And Land Claims is 7, Department of Land Affairs is 6, Yard is 3, and 1 is no offer, and 2 is only commercial. We are trying to ensure that we're trying to sell to in line with the government policy to the black farmers or HDI. And we are currently talking to the Department of Agriculture and Land Affairs to improve and systematize the operations in the manner we operate.
Thank you. So in other words, when you repossess a property, then when you do sell it, you only sell it to emerging farmers, am I correct?
There are two ways. When a farmer, let me explain the process. If a client...
Stick to the two ways.
Okay, there are two ways. One of it depends who buys. You know, when you go to an auction, and it is in the auction, then it's open to everyone. But if, because the price was less than the reference, we have a reference price, we buy it, that is what the honorable member has been talking about. Okay. Then it becomes part of our property. If it is part of our property, we have a relationship with the Department of Agriculture and Land Affairs in line with the government policy, that they will come and buy it to us. And most of that will go through BEV or Black Farmers, as I've already indicated. But the one that goes open on an auction is taken by anyone.
Sure, by
the guy who will get it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I just try to hammer on this point. I just want to make double sure. So what you are saying is if someone owes land bank, and then you guys are also at the auction and you're also bidding for these retrieved. Sometimes you buy it back, that's what you're doing. And then you have that property you call then a property in possession. Okay. So, but there was an auction on Tuesday in Malmesbury of a claim between Land Bank and Google Lady Farmers Propriety Limited. Why did this one go to an auction? If you are saying that you're only selling...
Okay, let me try and explain how does it go to an auction. After the legal process takes place, the land bank will have a reference price. That is, we call it a reserve. It says that if it's at this level or below this level, then we rather take it and put it in our own portfolio. But it's above that, then it gets to an auction. Then I can answer and say it means that that auction went through the auction.
Okay, I don't want to spend more time on this. On your list of properties in possession, for instance, the stuff in the three states, there's one farm in Bloemfontein, where it says the original cost is $825,000. And then there's a list of revaluation. I think you have the same document that I've got. Okay, so what does it mean, the revaluation? The original cost is $825,000, the revaluation is $225,000. Does that get added, or is it the... So that I just understand.
It's normally how the farm, the property works, is a person will buy it, put on equipment, and it's a promising piece of land or farm. Then it is a high price, of course, 800 or whatever the case might be. But by the time the people are defaulting, normally, that is supported by deterioration in the value of the property, like equipment and all related issues. And by the time the interest, by the time we come in, it's 2 years or so, the value is far less than what it was before.
No, okay, but this is very, very strange to me, because I don't know where you get this. Then, for instance, in KZN, you have a farm of 12 million, revaluation is 9 million. Another one in Limpopo, Modimolle, 18 million, revaluation 6.9 million. You have another one in Rustenburg, 1.5 million, revaluation 650. And so I can continue. So I think somewhere there's something wrong, unless I don't understand the
document. Can I explain that, please? The property you see in the third column, you have the same schedule, it's the listing price. So that is in the city, like the stock ledger of the financial records of the land bank. So from an accounting perspective, at the end of each financial period, the land bank needs to independently revalue those properties. So valuators go out and they place the value on. Some of them go up, so that gets added to the price that's on our listing, and some reduced. Then we also get bids for those properties, which is the deposit amount you see. We don't reduce the value by that. So we get from the listing price to the general ledger. We show the general ledger balance without the deposit, because the deposit we show is a credit. If the sale doesn't go through, we need to repay the farmer. So that's just a split. It's a reconciliation between the listing, where everything is in the land bank account, for the cost, the valuation, and the deposit. And to get to the financial statement, we take out the deposit amount and we show it separately under trade credit. So it's more like an accounting.
None of these properties have gone up. They've all been revaluated down, either that or not. Mr. Khadere, can I just ask you, you've been in the civil service a long time, or in the land?
Like government, 10 years.
Now, on Christmas Eve, the buildings, I mean, are there staff around, or are there the houses, or on holiday? Is anybody at Christmas Eve at the State Department, except the security guard and the necessity?
You expect an answer from me?
You see, what I want to know is, see, Chen, there's been money that's been transferred from the AgriBEE fund to by a land bank. And there's amount certain companies on land. But the one strange thing here, on Christmas Day, three amounts of money have been transferred to three DE companies. One amount, 9 million, another one is 9 million, and the other amount is 4.028 million. Could you give me some information on this?
That is being investigated for you, Chet. And we hope that it will conclude that we have the case number. So it is, it's not only the only one, the only case. The whole issue, there are a couple of transactions on RKPEA that the police are looking into. And that came up actually out of the first province that was done by a private company after the whistle had been blown. And then we got a private entity to do the investigation. And they came back to us, and they said there was a need for further problem. But through the media, it created the impression that we're not doing it. And I'm happy to say that we are in a second process now. They've done the further problem, but it's not only them, no problem. We also have the police involved. We have a case number. If the committee would like to have a case number.
Done a lot of work on that. And one of the risks we are facing is the land bank is the deterioration of the people we have put in the system. The first thing that we need to do is, of course, to engage with them and get to understand what is happening. But of course, we know the answer. The answer is just that the process, the time it takes for the land bank to respond is rather long. That's the first thing. Secondly, the negative media coverage that is around the land bank creates an environment where some of the clients are not that willing to interact with the land bank. So there's only one solution to that. You should go to the institution and tell them that we're going to turn around the institution, that the things we're cleaning up, that all the forensics that have been done with the police or with the Scorpio, that we're working very closely with the Treasury and government, and that we share the government policy. And we've already done so. But importantly is that we are able to indicate that we have stabilized the institution. The cost-to-income ratio comes down. The balance sheet gets better. The liquidity position is the best than ever been. We are no longer relying on 3 months. And immediately when it did so, they are coming back. And let me tell you, just this week, we met 10 of our best cooperatives, and all of them indicated that they will stay with us. There was one that was outside that indicated they are coming in. There's one big one, one of the biggest in South Africa that we throw. We are going to have a meeting with them, and they say they are coming back. It's because the institution is sustainable. We have challenges, but we're trying to cut the process from application to approval.
Well,
yes, sir.
Thank you, Jay. Mr. Khadebe, if you look in the annual report page 29, under assets, you have here investment properties. investing activities, second item there. Proceeds from disposal of investment properties, 11 million. That would be now the property that we've spoken about that we've sold successfully. Okay. Chair. Could you maybe tell me, I see in the annual report there's quite a lot of forensic investigations that are going on at the moment. How many are there, and what are they about? We don't want the details, but I mean, for instance, you mentioned about this ugly BB fund that's one there. And which ones are the other ones?
The second one is LGFU, and the third one is Masisa. But you have already counted the aggregates, so they are four, and they're all with the right authorities. We have decided to bring in the private investigator to look at a couple of cases that are outside of this forensics, because things are coming from time to time, and most probably with a cleanup, that is, we're looking at the audit report, we're looking at the management letter, things that were not right. We'll pick up a lot of things that need attention. And we know that police, SAPS, is already involved in a lot of things. So we get private investigators and we'll transfer to the police once we've done the work.
Tell me then, they say here also on page 36 at the bottom, about 50% of senior management posts are vacant. What are you doing to fill this as soon as possible?
This has been going on for some time. I think in the previous meeting, Minister did indicate that some of the people, not all, some of the people that have left or that are no longer in the employ were implicated in cases one or the other. But secondly, I think there has been a number of people that left because there have been opportunities outside and the land bank is under a lot of pressure. Now we have two options. The first option was to go look around for people, employ and put them in currently. But unfortunately, the strategy is not at a level, was not yet at a level where we can get people. And secondly, people are not willing to join the land bank. The best approach that we adopted then was to first interact with the government institutions that have the appropriate skills. Your DBSA, your IPC, they gave us outside skills. And we work on the turnaround strategy. Once we work on the turnaround strategy, it is only then that we can come up with the appropriate structure. And that's what we're going to do. But there are other skills that are necessary, with or without the strategy for the survival of the land bank. There are about 120 of them. We knew the land bank for 3 months, and we have appointed about 32. We hope that we will finish the process by June this year. All of that are in the place.
Thank you. You mentioned the forensic investigations, but in the AG's report, in his specific report, on page 39, this IT, was there also an investigation? Is that also one of these investigations? Okay. Then, some pertinent findings in his report is the following. Payment of salaries to suspended employees for an extended period as a result of drawn-out disciplinary procedures. We've spoken about that. Then payment of subsistence and travel allowance for employees in acting positions for an extended period of time. What are you doing to curb this?
Chair, that's why we have the cleanup. We wanted to highlight that. Those are things that could come in the clean, come up clear, and we're going to take appropriate action on that. What happened is the auditor came in and they picked up this. But you need to clean it up. You need to have a detailed analysis and verification of all of those things. And by the end of September next year, all those things will be done. But it's not only about audit report, as I've already indicated. It starts from qualification, it goes to issues of concern, it goes to management letter, internal audit, it goes to scope of resolution that we have to deal with, and I must say that we are running behind, but it's a fourth thing that we're going to look into. Currently, we're dealing with the first and the second one. There are conditions that were put forth by Minister of, by the Treasury on the conditions. We have to work on that. There were conditions and operations that were put forth by all the committees, agricultural committees, that we have to work on. But for us to be able to do so, we needed to prioritize the two way of starting. We have a team, and I'm lucky to say, I'm happy to indicate that the team that was auditing the land bank over the past 5 years we have retained them through the interaction with the auditor general. That team was over, and now we are helping us to clean up the whole landscape.
And then and the next one there is there's penalties and interest on late payments of taxes relating to, say, UIF and SEL.
commission and investigation, and we'll see what the conclusions are from that matter. We, as a consequence of this, have reported to SARS our intention, but we want to do a full PRY investigation, so that but we will do the investigation and represent the final results and outcome to SARS.
Just add, this is part of the cleanup. The cleanup team has already identified that issue, that you, in that issue that you don't have the appropriate skills. So I think that the memo which should be signed, and those are the people. It's going to cost us, it's not cheap, it's going to cost us a land bank a lot of money, but we want to clean the state of about 2-3 million.
Then the last one, the expenditure of 7.8 million for special forensic investigation completed during September 2007 on land for development loans, for which investigation no further actions have been taken to date. Have there been any actions taken since the report?
It's been given to the police, the authorities, they would have to make a task to do that. At that time, we had not yet arrived at that level.
In addition, we actively in the process of disposing of that book because it's outside the mandate of the bank. So we put procedures in place and contracts all the time indicating that we want to dispose of the book and we're looking for potential new financiers.
And my next question has there been, let me phrase it this way. The AG says here, I was unable to confirm or verify the alternative means that the Minister of Land Affairs and Agriculture or the Minister of Finance had approved the following payments. First, determination of 4.7 million paid to the former CEO, and then the other one, the elimination paid by the land bank to a former acting CEO. Has anything happened since?
Yes, we engaged with the minister's office, and it was made apparent that the 4.7 settlement was not signed by the minister but by the board.
But how does that, in terms of the legislation, I mean, how does it work?
Unfortunately, we would have to recover the money or it becomes a wasteful expenditure. And the board actually did discuss this yesterday in a board meeting as to measures and means that we need to adopt to deal with the issue.
So you are saying the board gave this money or paid this former CEO that money without the permission of the minister, is that what you're saying?
With the information available, yes.
I want to come back to this one issue with the moratorium on the collection of debtors, also mentioned by the Auditor General in the statistics report. It's number 22 here on page 43. The land bank, on instruction from the former CEO, has placed a moratorium on the collection of loans made to emerging farmers. How does this work when these loans are also connected to property? Because you just now said earlier on that certain properties you buy in, you eventually sell them, and so on.
Oh, I did the way it just contributed to the financial situation of the land bank, you know, where we find ourselves. But at that time, if Chair allows me, the decision that made the people arrive at that conclusion was that there would be closer cooperation between different units within agriculture, that's the Department of Agriculture, Land Bank, and Land Affairs, in ensuring that they assist each other, but it took a bit longer. But having said so, yes, that had an impact. And because the bank is struggling to survive with virtual currency, we then resolved that that moratorium would have to be uplifted. But we are talking to the Department of Agriculture and Land Affairs to find means and ways of ensuring that the government policy is not ignored.
If I take you to page 76, these are, I take it, your offices, the list of your offices, right? Beaufort West, Bethlehem, Bloemfontein, Calfinia, etc., etc. What is that sixth one there, Scheme 25/1979, Cape Town? That is 4.2 million.
Okay, that is it's a flat that land bank, and we have resolved that we don't need that. We don't come more often in Cape Town. We're putting in the market, and we felt that the market is still too tight, so we're renting it out.
And where is this land bank?
It's in what is the Green Point. Yes, it's there. We are going to put the market once situation improves. But then you add that this is part and parcel of cost of reducing cost to income ratio. It meant we had to sell the Mercedes Benz owned by the CEO, changing the flight from for hire for executive, maybe a few people from business accounts to that, move from 4 to 3 to staff. We found also that the land bank was sponsoring all the stadiums and rugby. You know, we have cut that. That is why the cost of income has come down from 83 to about 7 million or so. But we continue doing so. Once the market changes, we'll start.
Then, just on that item as well, I take it it's the office here in Cape Town next to the garden, 3865. You have a valuation on the land there, 16 million, and you have valued the buildings at 3 point something million. But last year, your valuation on the land was 3.6 million, and the buildings was valued at 4.9. Why is that like that?
My understanding is that there's an annual valuation that is done, and that's just the outcome of the valuation.
But this is a problem. I know you're doing annual valuations on all your offices. Am I right? So how does the valuation jump from 3.6 million on the land only to 16 million in 12 months? And then, but the building itself goes down from 4.9 to 3.04 million. and then eventually it went to death.
complicated transaction. The company, I think, originated from Sweden, and it entered an agreement with the land bank on assisting the land bank to turn around the institution. Thereafter, it didn't perform that well, but because of the contract, this is 1999, I think, when it started. And then at some stage, land bank, I think it was 3 or 4 years back, felt that there should be a settlement on the agreement of about 32 million or so on this company, excluding VAT. But the company has come back again, it's demanding that 120 is reached out now with interest. And we have the legal people working on that. And it's the first time, and we think we have a case to win. But it needs some further investigation internally, because when the DIBA signed that about 120 million of non-performing loans would be managed by this company, the return on the land bank was only 1.2 million or 2 million, that's what I'm expecting. We think that it doesn't make economic sense to enter such a deal. Let's get to understand exactly how they are after that. So it is a condition that is going through the legal process of return.
Chairman, my last question. The AG makes mention of the fact that your declaration of interest of your senior staff and directors wasn't up to standard. And then also on page 100, there is loan debtors of people, two non-executive directors who had interest in entities that had loans with land bank. Now, is that case still the same?
We have since rectified the situation, the declaration of interest by staff, and we are just waiting for external auditors to confirm that. We need external auditors to run that up. Regarding other the workers that have an interest that are implicated, of course, the cleanup team will give us a clear direction as to what we need to do. That was an audited document. Now we are cleaning up and we'll make judgments. And the legal process will take its course, should it be the direction.
Yeah, I might have questions later on this, but that's for instance.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Commissioner? Thank you. I just have two questions. I didn't focus on this one, but two questions that lead into it now, so there might be silly questions, but you have educated me. The first one, did I understand correctly that you indicated that the board pay equivalent fee to some individual without the necessary permission? You then took a decision yesterday to get that money back. If you could explain that process.
We will meet, as said, and it was discussed at the board meeting, and we'll need maybe a little opinion to see what options we have, because we'll need to get the money back. Should we not, then it becomes a wasteful expenditure.
We have time frame. When I say, if you say you're going to get a legal opinion, and I'm happy about that. When was this money paid? You know, I'm trying to understand the sequence of events. We paid this individual at a particular time. 6 months down the line, the board takes a decision. Or 2 days down the line, the board takes a decision. I'm trying to understand the sequence like I'm trying to understand. It's so that we can understand if the thing is moving fast enough. That's the decision that we need to arrive at. Let's go.
The individual was paid with 31st of August, 07. Let me explain then the process up until then. And that board was changed. Then, but between September until March 07, there was no fully constituted board as the Minister of Agriculture.
March 08.
Oh, wait. No, 07. No, 08. 08, sorry, 08, yes. As the Minister of Agriculture was putting in a new board. But the new board came in March, I mean, to be fully constituted. So the March, am I talking, yes? Yes, March, yes, March 08. And immediately,
maybe I'm confused. You're saying that you were paid in August 08?
No, 07.
No. No, you were paid in
August
2000.
2008, the new board comes in, and is at the end of the financial year, and the land bank is facing severe challenges. The new board then begins to work on the processes and everything. Until now, we still have the same board. So what I'm trying to highlight is that there was a period of time where the controls at the land bank were weaker than, maybe in March 08 or May 09 when the board was already operating. Hence the time it took then for the bank to deal with this issue. But this is not the only issue. There are a number of issues. The SCOPA resolution, the guarantees, and all other things that the land bank had to deal with at that time. But because of this environment and the fact that at management level, 50% of the management were vacant positions did not allow the land bank to arrive at the conclusions which was expected to be.
No, that's fine. I understand that part of it, but I'm quite comfortable with that. I think the question that has bogged down SCOPA for many years and we raised it this week because we'd hate it to happen to you is the whole issue around prescription. We don't want a situation where you come back to SCOPA and you say, you know, we did want to get this money, but now the time has prescribed. So one day when the individual wins the lotto or gets this money, we'll get it back from him. And we can give you many cases of senior government officials where this has happened. So I think there is the, for both of our sakes, not a situation where this debt is prescribed because of lack of action from our side. We sometimes get a situation where the department comes back to us and says the attorney general or the state attorney or somebody like that gave them a hard time or was not acting correctly. I think what we are saying is you need to do this and you need to be cognizant of all these loopholes that certainly from our experience we know have existed. So that's the first one. It's just a statement by way of answering that. The second one, I want to refer you to page 113. I don't know if you have your annual report.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, it's just a so that I understand these things, Chair. We will maybe do the thing more intelligently the next time we engage. You know, we're comparing the liquidity risk. And one of the line items is post-retirement obligation. Last year, your obligation was 182 million rand. This year, it's 202 million rand, if you round it up. With me? So that is an increase of about 90 or 20 million rand. The first question that I'm asking is how many staff members do we have, and is this more or less the type of increment we're going to see every year? Because, and I know it's a provision. I know it's a provision, but just from our understanding, do we provide for 19 million rand? How many staff members are we talking about?
Team was discontinued some years ago, so that's for the employees, but we're under that scheme then. The number of employees is actually set out on, I think it's on page 86. But while we're page into that page, what I can say is this is actually really valid. So we get the actuaries to value this liability. The evaluation is very complex. So independent people do the valuation and the land bank being expense. You're correct, but that is basically an expense of 20 million for the land bank, an increase in the liability. Honorable members. In terms of the number of members, 428 members.
You're saying that you have done the evaluation with actuaries or you're going to do it? I think it's been done already.
It's done already.
I'm saying the 400 members that we are basically catering for? 400 odd members,
yes.
Not members.
nothing, I suspect there would be another 20 million this year.
Can we appeal that you look at it and give us the option? Because right, 20 million rand a year clearly is going to be a problem.
Yeah, we just one on that. We will look at it. The Bank of God is international financial reporting standards. So within that standard, we'll see what we can do. But I don't want to make promises and say we will be able to. We'll look at options and get some expert help, but we will need to see what needs to happen. Thanks.
Yes, go ahead, Pierre.
One question regarding your exposure to few clients, quite 112. You have your large and you had exposure to 11 clients to the amount of 7.3 billion, and this year 6 clients to an amount of 5.75 billion. But then you say in the last sentence there that one of these clients has actually reduced, settled its account and reduced it with another billion. So you've basically got 5 clients left that are actually exposed to the bank about 4.7 billion. What are the chances of further reducing that exposure to too few people?
That's a big risk in the company, you know. There's a lot of cross litigation, and we are doing measures to ensure that we do not rely on those 4 or 5. If we had a chance to maybe make a presentation, we would have indicated that the whole strategy of the bank going forward is revolving, so that we begin to target the market which allows us to have a niche. Because currently, the reliance on interest rates and the move to corporate only, or commercial funding, create a situation where we have to depend or compete with the private bank. And the banks are beating us on the price, on the product, on the speed, on the efficiency. We cannot do that. But the strategies that was discussed earlier today would at least enhance the opportunities for us to then get into the market where we produce new products. Having said so, let me hasten to add that some of the clients that left us last year and this year are steadily coming back. But the challenge that the land bank is facing is that the big exposures are primarily with those clients who are, you know, safe to say this. But the risk is still big whether we are safe or not safe. You can't have so much of the book being controlled or exposed to such few players. It's something that will gradually reduce, informed by our strategy. Ultimately, we have to be away from that, because at maximum, at least the exposure by an individual should be about 25%. That's the credit rule, so we're beyond that.
Thank you very much. For the number of years that we've integrated the land bank, this is the first time that we have the head of the CEO coming. They either speak or not there or this and that. So hopefully this is a good sign. We're happy that you both are here leading your team, so that whatever response they're giving us and whatever commitment they're giving us, it is made by people who have the authority to go ahead and ensure that these are implemented. Two issues. One, it is the, I think you will agree with me, chairperson of the board, that if you look at the records of the board going back, you'll find that there has been a lot of instability, both the board level and the corporate management level. I think that is an issue of serious concern. Not only for the left bank, but for all public departments that we interact with, because this has a direct impact on continuity of
very convincing and looked very, very serious with what they wanted to do. But as you can attest, things have gone in a different direction. So we without being empiristic, but the empirical evidence makes us a bit, you know, concerned. Because we want stability, and we want the bank to be able to play the role it is supposed to play. Very strategic, very important role. But I think its leadership has really not lived up to both the administrative and political expectations of the bank. And this has affected the turnaround, as the acting CEO has indicated. So even not called turnaround, but the Shaluga, which is better than turning around to make it sound, it sounded pathetic. And, but the point I'm making still goes back to stability. Mr. Hatemi, you're acting. Not sure for how long. And whether or not somebody is going to come, you go back to the Shantrader, what the implication of that will be in terms of the momentum, in terms of the focus, and in terms of quality of leadership, because in everything you may have the politics, but there is that personality factor that comes into it. So I'm saying, therefore, that these become concerns for us going forward. Not so much as we have seen, let's say, it becomes difficult for us to go into the past of all the issues that are in the annual report, because you have come in after the fact. Question is going forward, how to deal with this issue. And I must say that so far, I have an impression that you have a firm grip on the issue. But if that firm grip is going to be, you know, for a short while, once again, it brings us back to where we started. So I think that from the side of the committee, all continuity, stability, and leadership level, so we are able to effect all the mental changes that are supposed to turn the bank around. In the absence of which, we're just moving in cycles. So, I think that's where we want to leave it at, to emphasize that we do think that you have a sense of what the areas of challenge are. And that, however, you need the time to be able to push through all the issues that you're facing. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. We really appreciate that. But I would like to highlight, Chair, that we already have put in a monitoring system that will be coming in at the end of December this year, end of March, and September. That is intended for all the stakeholders to take a view and judge us whether we're performing according to what we seek to do. But having said that, let me hasten to add that we have to judge us by the annual report next year. We might be qualified because of a long list of things that have to come. But we are confident with the team, with the support from the trader in Agriculture, that we'll be far bigger story, better story. If we had run the financials just the first 6 months, you would have noticed that they are developing. We are beginning to have great policy on that.
Chair, I would like to react, but the Honourable Minister has given
me the opportunity.
Chair, I would just like to react in terms of the stability issue. Of course, when things go wrong, people seem to jump ship. And right now, we're busy with three things, three different phases. There's a cleanup, a stabilization, and the stability of the bank. And the sustainability, I'm sorry. And this process is really going very well. And the turnaround strategy has been approved by the board. And I want to assure you that in terms of management, there's ownership, there's excitement, there's loyalty.
country, we realize that the institution must play a very important role in terms of development. And we support the management in this difficult task. It's very, very unfortunate that we have to start with the bank at the level where it is, because it should play a much more important role. And we are really working very hard to fast track this.
Right. Thank you very much. Last but not least, COVID minute. Yes. The mic just pressed it until it turned red.
Thank you. I just wanted to correct the issue on the board. There wasn't a time when there was no board in the land bank. The threat from November or so last year, there was a number of board members either resigned, either asked to leave, because some of them were involved in the illegal transactions that were taking place, for instance, the Gulf estate and so on. And it was quite a challenge to get the correct people, and also the consultation that had to go on between my ministry, the Ministry of Finance, and Cabinet and the Presidency. So it was not an easy process, also taking into consideration that we're going into Christmas and holiday time and so on. But I also wanted to say that the CEO and the board have done a lot of work, particularly cleaning up. There was a huge corruption in the land bank. As you can see, some of it dating back from 1999, if not earlier. A huge amount of money that left the bank unaccounted for. And I would like, therefore, to, I'm also shocked that people that were dismissed, because most of the people that were suspended, as the Honorable Member has asked, were found guilty after a hearing was held. I'm shocked that they continued to take salaries from the bank. There could be systems that need to be cleaned up, but I think a person as senior as a CFO should actually blow the whistle and not take money that does not belong to him. So I want to agree with the CEO and the board that all these monies must be demanded back, paid back to the land bank. And lastly, Chair, on the issue of the properties in possession, it's our concern that most of the time, even after investing as the Department of Agriculture in some of these farms, you know, using cash money, building irrigation equipment and so on, these farms are sold at a price that is even lower to what the government paid for some of the developing farmers. So we are working very closely with the CEO and the Department of Land Affairs and Department of Agriculture. But of course, we have constraints, budgetary constraints, but we are trying what we can to assist and ensure that the people who are affected are assisted in a way so that at least we do not see a reversal of our land reform program and the gains that we have made thus far. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister. Chairperson, anything you want to say?
Chair, if I'm given the time, I would just like to share with you a couple of good things that have happened as well.
Very good.
May I? Very good, yes. Thank you very much. First of all, I would just like to say that the Land Bank turnaround strategy has been completed and it has been approved by the board, and this has now been sent to the shareholder, the Minister of Finance, for his approval. And then I would also like to say that the strategy now focuses on development as core to the land bank business. And this is the third time that the land bank has adopted such a strategy since the promulgation of the Land Bank Act in 2002. And we've also arrived at the conclusion that for the land bank to turn around, it needs to stop the bleeding. We've discussed that. And we have agreed on how this can be done, the cleanup process and stabilizing of the bank. And therefore, a strategy has been developed and to make the bank stable. And a lot of achievements have also been made in that regard. We're also busy improving our HR capacity and to enhance our IT system so that we have a system and a process to support what we need to do. And from a bank's board point of view, this, of course, is very important. We know that you are disappointed in terms of the promises that have been made in the past, but as the CEO has indicated, we will like to be judged by the report, our annual report for next year. But I think what really supports the strategy is the fact that it has been developed from a bottom-up approach. And everybody in the bank has been involved. And the management also at branch level has bought into it. And they're sharing in this vision. And to me, that is very, very promising. And added to that, in terms of shareholders, I'm talking of investors, clients, government departments, and so forth, they're all buying into this system. What I think is of importance is to say that we see that things are improving. And this is shown by our highly improved liquidity position, our maturity of our loans that are lengthened. More investors are buying our paper, and of course the income is decreasing, the balance sheet is improving, and we are also, as we have indicated, in the process of disposing the LDFUs. And we also see that more and more qualified people are now willing to join the bank. So from that angle, Chair, I really think things are improving. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much on that positive and hopeful note as we end our proceedings for the year. I'd like to thank the Auditor General Office and staff for the success we've had so far. This being our last meeting for the year. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Yeah. She found it.
He said he's not finding it from my apartment.
Okay,
yeah. Well, it's nice to have a